America, in the middle of the freaking day, how are you? The Mike Chambers Radio Show here on this Wednesday, 3rd of February, 2010. Glad everyone is with us for the broadcast today. Kind of a sad day. Found out this morning that Eustace Mullins, probably one of the most prolific writers about things like the Federal Reserve, the New World Order, this whole system that we exist under, died at the age of 87, and he's passed on, he'd had a stroke about 3 weeks ago, another one, and I think that might have marked the third or fourth stroke that he had, and he's passed on, and we're going to comment about Eustace coming up here in just a little bit on the program. It is indeed a sad thing. I had the opportunity to interview him and talk with him on more than one, I interviewed him once, but talked with him on more than one, occasion, and never had a chance to sit down face to face with him. But my conversations with him were very interesting, and he is someone that I will sorely miss. I had spent some time trying to track him down. He'd been on basically a tour, and we were going to try to get him on one last time, and do an interview with him, and that opportunity is gone, and I. We are at the loss for that. But we'll talk about that, about Eustace's impact, all of that coming up. And I would love to hear your comments about Mr. Mullins as well. And I certainly referred to him as Mr. Mullins and called him Mr. Mullins. He was the quintessential Southern gentleman in so many aspects of the word, and maintained a grace and a dignity throughout all of this. A lot of people tried to steal everything he had over the years, and... But the most dangerous man in the world has passed away at the age of 87, and we'll talk about that. Also, there's hunger rising in this country is up 46%. Can you believe that 46%? And I think we may have State Senator Randy Brogdon on with us today from Oklahoma. I think he's coming on in the 2 to 3 o'clock hour on the show today, and I'm going to double check that. I believe so. I think Ms. Jane has that information. And I will make sure on that, but I think he's coming on with us today. He's running for the office of governor here in my state of Oklahoma as a Republican. He's going up against a lady by the name of Mary Fallon, who is in Congress now. And she's a former lieutenant governor. She's very popular in the state. Randy's a popular guy too. But she has quite a bit of name recognition and is the mainstream choice for, governor. But Randy has been one of these individuals that have stood up for state sovereignty and what's right, and he, along with people like Charles Key in this state, have stood up for that and the 10th Amendment and the rights of the states and state sovereignty. And so we should be talking, I think we're talking with him in the 2 to 3 o'clock hour today, and I will double check on that. But he's either scheduled for today or next Wednesday. I don't recall. And a mind is a terrible thing to waste. I am the poster child. But we'll get into this about Eustace and the news, information, all of that coming up on the program today. Stay with us. This is the Mike Chambers Radio Show.
Trouble to turn into a struggle halfway across Alabama. Well, a hound broke down and left us all. visited downtown Birmingham. Right away I bought me a blue train ticket right across Mississippi clean. I was on that midnight flyer out of Birmingham smoking in the New Orleans. Somebody help me get out of Louisiana, just help me get to Houston town. There are people there who care a little about me and have all let the poor boy down. Through the promised land, working on a T-bone steak, all the carted flying over to the Golden State. The pilot told us in 13 minutes he was headed to the terminal.
All right, back here on the Mike Chambers radio program, and yes, indeed, State Senator Randy Brogdon from Oklahoma will be the guest on the broadcast today later, so we will have him on in the 2 to 3 o'clock hour today. So that's going to be an interesting conversation. Looking forward to talking with Mr. Brogdon, running for governor here in Oklahoma. So I just had to confirm that. Yes, indeed. So today he'll be on with us on the broadcast. But chat room, by the way, is open at MikeChambersLive.com. And you can pop on in and join us for the interactive portion of the broadcast. The number today, if you want to comment on Eustace Mullins and, you know, his life and his work, please do. The number 866-841-1065. That's 866-841-1065. Or 512-904-8014. That's 512-904-8014. And certainly I was looking around and doing my regular preparation for the program and found out this morning that indeed Eustace Mullins was dead at the age of 87. And I've got to say, when I began doing a radio program, I was mainly focused on a couple of issues. And it wasn't until I came across Eustace Mullins' work on the Federal Reserve, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. And Eustace Mullins, that particular book was a literal epiphany and has taken me down so many other roads. And that has to be one of the key pieces of work, of information, of research that I have looked at that has just taken me up on so many different tangents and directions to find out more about things. And I am forever in his debt for what he has done, the work he has done. As I mentioned before the break, I had the opportunity to interview him. I spent probably 2.5 hours with him on the phone, and plus a couple of previous conversations and a couple of conversations after that off air with him, and I found him to be one of the most intelligent individuals I've ever run across in my life. He was a man, even in his old age, and when I talked to him, he was almost 85, was still sharp in his mind, and even after his strokes, he was in an assisted living center for a while. Even then, he had a little difficulty speaking. But once, it was funny, once you got Eustace warmed up at that point, he was just a freight train of information. And my conversations with him were just so good, and the fact that he let me into some things regarding his personal life and things that were, I felt honored to have been able to have been a part of that conversation. And the fact that he chose to speak with me, and he was so nice. He would talk to anybody. You dial him up, and he answered the phone. He did all his own scheduling. Would spend absolutely as much time with you as you wanted to regarding anything. I mean, and he knew about so many. He was versed in so many different areas that it was so interesting that in the talk that I had with him in the space of 2 hours, we covered literally 250, 300 years of history. We went through so many different things. And I've listened to that interview. I replayed the interview a number of times. And it has been one of those interviews that has been requested over and over by people over the years, the last 3 years. And to me, it was my most favorite interview, and will always be, because of just how interesting the man himself was. This was a man who was labeled by J. Edgar Hoover as the most dangerous man in the world. And thanks to J. Edgar Hoover's mother, Eustace Miles remained alive because they were looking to off the guy. And Hoover's mother liked him, and this goes back to an era of politics in this country when there was access to people, when these people were approachable. Today, in the realm of politics in this country, people in Congress, in the Senate, the House, the President, the heads of these agencies are no longer approachable. You can't walk into their office and sit down with them as you could when Eustace Mullins was in his prime. We're talking about the 50s and the 60s and even the late 40s. He met Ezra Pound, I believe, in 1948. Former radar operator, was involved in some early work in television with the Army. He volunteered for the Army. He was a native of Staunton, Virginia, and lived most of his life there. And it's interesting where, you know, he had... he told me straight up. I said, well, what? So you volunteered for the Army? He said, oh, yeah. He said, there were no jobs. So we all went in. We thought... He had told me that, a lot of people thought that the war was crazy. But still, it was a paycheck. And they were there. And he talked about his life and talked about a lot of the things that he had done, places that he had been, things that he'd come across, the research he'd done, how he'd met Ezra Pound, who at the time was in a mental institution, for comments that he had made over Italian radio back during the war. And basically, he was calling the Roosevelt administration out and calling it a spade, but he paid the price for it. Just as Mullins did. Mullins, at one point in time, was afraid for his life after writing The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. He worked at the Library of Congress, was an actual employee there until he came out with that book and they got rid of him. It's interesting where he tells a story that while he was doing research and writing Secrets of the Federal Reserve, Ezra Pound gave him a small little stipend a week or every 2 weeks to kind of keep him going as he was doing this research full time. Because up until that point, nobody had looked into the Federal Reserve at all. Here was this bank. It had been others, lauded as this great institution. Others like Congressman McFadden and Charles Lindbergh Sr. had demonstrated it to be exactly what it was. But he tells an interesting story, and we'll pick it up when we come back, as we remember Eustace Mullins here for a bit on the Mike Chambers radio program. Everybody stay with us. Back in just a minute. Mike Chambers radio program. How you doing? How you doing? How you doing? Glad you're with us today. And it's a sad day, the passing of Eustace Mullins, but again, his work, his life's effort to get information to people has spawned an entirely new generation. A lot of people didn't even know who Mullins was, really until the last 5-6 years. And there was a huge resurgence in his books. Most of them had been out of print. and a huge resurgence in his books. Some of his books, his Curse of Canaan book, fetches a pretty penny. He had talked about reissuing a number of those books and reprinting them, and I think some had he gotten around to some doing some of them, but not all of them. But original copies of his books on eBay, I've seen them fetch a very dandy price. But he told me a story about while he was there researching the secrets of the Federal Reserve, and he needed a place to stay. Well, he was there at the Library of Congress doing his research, and he found a dressing room that was in an anterior of a little auditorium there at the Library of Congress in down in the basement. Well, what Mullins did is Mullins, in the end, was staying in that room. He basically appropriated it and made it his apartment. Nobody knew, because what he would do is he would leave before anybody there at the Library of Congress showed up. He was able to clean up, do all that kind of stuff, and he'd show up, he'd be there at the front door. His car was always parked out front. This was in the days when you parked right up in front. There were no parking lots, you just pulled right up. And so he lived in this place for quite some time, and in the interview, it took me about 10 minutes to get out of him that he basically appropriated the room, that he wasn't a guest of the Library of Congress in the room, or anything like that. And it was so funny the way he was beating around the bush with me regarding his appropriation of said room. He just took the room. He didn't ask. He didn't pay rent. He didn't do anything. He just took the room. And so finally, after 10 minutes, I finally said, "So you appropriated the room?" And there was a brief pause, and of course he says, "Well, yes." And said, I just died laughing because we went getting him to that point where he would admit that he appropriated the room was so funny. And he was so good-humored and so good-natured. And as I said previously, he had the grace and the dignity of the quintessential Southern gentleman, and that's how I will remember him and his work. That goes without saying. There's no his research. There's no comparison, to that. It's a great thing. And I just to be able to be a short part of his life just for a brief few hours, I think was to me an utter privilege and something I will never forget. And it meant the world to me to be able to spend time with him. Here was a guy that would just gave him himself. There were so many people who tried to rip him off over the years. And recently, somebody in Texas basically had gotten themselves somewhat of a power of attorney and was basically going to fleece this guy for everything he had. And that's sad. And finally someone was able to get him away and get him some care, get him a little more healthy than he was, and kind of get him back going again. And because nobody could find him. No, I mean, nobody could find him. We had searched and searched and searched. Michael Vail and I had searched and couldn't find him. And we about him once a month. Michael, have you heard from him? No, I haven't heard from him. Does this number work? No, we couldn't find him. And then come to find out this guy, I think his name was Jesse, had rescued him and was able to, to get him back, somewhat. And they made a tour and he was doing some speaking engagements and the like and meeting with people. And it was a very cool thing. And I was glad to see that his final days were happy and the like after so many people had taken advantage of him. The state of Virginia had labeled him mentally incompetent, took away the driver's license. He was far from incompetent. Far from incompetent mentally. And it was just so, when you spoke with him and you listened to the depth and breadth of his knowledge, It was just very, very... it was just a way of drawing you in to his conversation and what he wanted to talk about. And he was just... He reminded me in many ways of, like, Andy Griffith. And it even reminded me of my dad a lot. That Southern charm and that's what I will remember about him and what I'll cherish about him. And of course, if you'd like to comment on him about him, feel free to do so. I'd love to hear your thoughts and about him. But a number of books, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, you can read online, and we'll have it posted up on the website here before too long, so that you can take a look at it and peruse through it. It's a short book, but he goes into the lineage of people, bloodlines, how all this ties up, and I mean all of this. It's amazing how all of this stuff works, how these people are intertwined, intertangled together. And he was one of the first to start picking all this stuff out and to start putting it out. And his loss today, yeah, I agree with Will. It rivals the loss of Bill Cooper. Bill Cooper assassinated his front lawn back in Eager, Arizona, and in 2001. These are the type of losses right here that, you know, we can fairly we cannot afford to lose it, these type of people. We need people to step in their place, and we are seeing that. There are more and more writers that are coming on board, more and more researchers that are starting to look at information, and I find that to be just absolutely wonderful. And they're sparked and spurred on by people like Mullins, by people like Bill Cooper, and those who have come before us, people like Jordan Maxwell, that did a lot of this work, did it early on, and have paid a huge price many of us will never have to pay, as far as what these gentlemen have had to pay, because they broke the ground. And they've left us a plot of land that we can till so much more effortlessly than the ground they were tilling when they first broke this ground. All right. A quick break. We'll come back, dive into the news. Everybody stay with us. It's the Mike Chafin radio program, back in a flash. They are screaming. It's such a good time. New York is dangerous. 'Cause you reach that way, you may. Even a blind man could see that's not so. Mike Chambers radio program on this hump day, 3rd of February, 2010. Yes, indeed. Lines open 866-841-1065 or 512-904-8014. To the phones we go, down Dallas way. Let's talk to Lark. Lark, thanks for holding. You're on the Mike Chambers radio program.
Mike, good morning. How are you?
I am doing well. Thank you. How are you?
Well, I wanted to chime in about Eustace Mullins.
Sure, go ahead.
And I wanted to put something to you that and to your listeners, and in hopes I can find an answer. You know, Eustace Mullins had alluded on more than one occasion to the fact that Ezra Pound was corresponding with, I believe his name was C.E. Douglas, the man who wrote about something called social credit. And then later, Lewis Evan wrote about this thing called social credit. And Eustace himself had claimed that he also had some thoughts and ideas about how useful something called social credit could be. I wonder if you're familiar with any of that or have heard of it.
I have not. I have not. But I know that he had so much insight into a number of things and information, you know, based on conversations that he had had with Pound, because Pound was a true mentor to Mullins. Mullins originally planned on being a sculptor and had no interest in writing whatsoever. And when he met Pound, Pound began encouraging him to write, and then put him on this mission about the Federal Reserve, and of course the rest is history. But as to what all their conversations were, I don't have a big insight into all the conversations that they had on the subjects that they dealt with, or all of the Eustace's writings or even thoughts.
Well, I wanted to put that bug in your ear because hopefully either yourself or some of your listeners would help me research that, because I find that pretty interesting. If you simply do a search on social credit and Lewis Evan, that's spelled E, V as in Victor, E-N, Lewis Evan. And I believe in that piece by Lewis Evan on social credit, you'll find the references to Mr. Douglas, who was the perhaps the originator, but at least the foremost proponent for this thing called social credit. And I just find that fascinating that such a thing would arise during the time of World War II in the mind of someone like Ezra Pound, who, of course, I've always admired. But that's why I called this morning, because I just want to get that message out, that in some of his later interviews that I heard on the radio, he, Eustace Mullins, had alluded to this thing called social credit. And, of course, Ezra Pound's correspondent with Mr. Douglas. So, anyway, I just, of course, like yourself, found the man fascinating.
Yeah, and I regret that I found him way too late. That there was so many things that that once I interviewed him, and there were other interviews that that I was part of that where I produced them, but wasn't actually a physical commentator in the interviews. That, you know, in so many different roads that he went down. Unfortunately, this was not one of those roads that was addressed. And I found the book written by C.H. Douglas in, I guess, 1879, and then a new edition that came out in the 30s. And at real-debt-elimination.com. And so I'll take a look into this and see, because I think there are some mentions of Mullins in this page based on a quick Google search that I did. So I will see, but others may have an idea as to what Mullins' thoughts regarding social credit were.
As far as if any of your listeners are interested, they could go into archives.org and do some searches, because there's a lot of things still available on the Internet that have been written and or reported by Mullins. But that's a pretty great expository of knowledge right there.
Yes, it is.
But yeah,
it is.
I'm glad that you brought his name. Glad you brought his name out as being C.H. Douglas. Did you say debt-elimination?
Yeah, real-debt-elimination.com.
Real-debt-elimination with hyphens.com?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, very good. Yeah, I've got that bookmarked. That's where I probably found it. But very good. Anyway, carry on, and I appreciate you taking my call.
I will most definitely. This is interesting here about this social credit. So you've given, Lark, dead gummy, you've given me something else to look at.
Well, actually, you know, I think basically what I recall in my reading about it is that we could design an economy in such a way that you could basically collectivize the productive capacity of a population group, say of the American people.
Right.
And what this would do is would give everybody essentially about $1,000 a month as what we call a social credit. And of course, if you chose to live extremely frugally, and or organize your life in some cooperative ways, you could practically live on that amount of money. And what this was designed for was so that we could take care. So basically what we would do is we would eliminate things like government handouts and so much of this socialism simply by redesigning the monetary system and the economy in such a way that we could take care of the people in our society that really are not productive any longer. But it wouldn't harm the productive sector of the economy. That's what is fascinating about the whole concept, is because it's non-coercive and it doesn't infringe on the rights of others.
Well, this is something a road that I'm going to go down and take a look at, and I will probably try to read some of this book since it's online for free, and see exactly what Mr. Douglas had to say regarding social credit. And find out about it. But I find that interesting. The idea of collectivism, first off, turns me off. But Rowan and Martin had talked about, or Rowan and McDonald, every time I think of them, I think of Laugh-In. The authors of the book, They Own It All, Including You, by Means of Toxic Currency, talked about the states printing their own currency based on the labor and productivity of the inhabitants of that state. And that might be something that would kind of meld together with this idea. I'm not sure, and that's what I want to look at and see if indeed we're talking about the same thing or we're talking about two different things here.
Well, of course, the most interesting new development that I've seen is Ron Paul's proposed new bill, which would not limit, would basically do away with the monopoly of the currency currently in place and allow for free choice and competition, which is a fabulous idea. Currency should be what two people or two parties make of it. It's either acceptable within the constraints of the laws of contract, or it's not.
Right.
For example, if you and I want to do a trade and we don't want to use Fed notes, why in the hell shouldn't we?
Sure, exactly. And interestingly enough here, Lark, there are a few states. There's a bill in Indiana, Colorado, Missouri, Georgia, and Maryland that are looking for the states to say, hey, if we want to trade in gold and silver, we can trade in gold and silver, and bye-bye to the Federal Reserve note. So I find that interesting, the timing in all of this, and Ron Paul's bill regarding that very same thing. And I appreciate the call. Quick break here. And like I said, I will look into more of this as we on the social credit idea aspect. But quick break here. Come back in a minute with more. Stay with us. It's the Mike Chambers Radio Program. Back here on the Mike Chambers Radio Program. Glad you're with us today. 866-841-1065 or 512-904-8014. And you can chat room open to MikeChambersLive.com. We had Bill in New York holding. I guess we lost him. Bill, if you want to call back, please do. And we'll get straight to your call. It's interesting here that a number of states now calling for gold and silver money. You've got bills in Indiana. They Senate Bill 453, Colorado HB 09-1206, Missouri House Bill 0561, Georgia HB 430, and Maryland HJR 5, House Joint Resolution 5. None of these bills have yet passed. They basically are saying the state has to operate based on gold and silver. They also say the banking system has to allow people to operate using gold or silver. According to the author here, they believe using a paper note backed 100% by gold or silver would be allowed. The only thing that I see as a problem is, look, I would love a gold and silver backed currency. The problem is we don't have any gold. It's gone. It's been stolen. And I think that's one of the misnomers about this, where everybody goes down this road. Well, we need gold and silver, a metals-backed currency. Hey, I agree. But where are you going to get it? And that's part of the problem, is it's been stolen. It's been taken away. I mean, we talked about this just the other day. Gold assets of the U.S. government, as of September 2009, only $11,041,000,000. Now, that's hardly enough to even begin to build an economy off of. We're a country of 300 million people plus. When you get state budgets running into the business, it's possible that if we were to eradicate the inflation, and maybe you could, which is a few billion dollars, and maybe this trillion with a T number is so big because everything is so inflated, and it's possible there. But the problem is these yo-yos have stole the money, stole the gold. Roosevelt stole it from the American people, turned around and sold it at a profit to these foreigners and foreign banks, and most of it's sitting in a Rothschild's vault somewhere. There indeed lies the problem. Back to the phones we go. Let's go to Brian in Arizona. Brian, thanks for waiting. You're on the program. Go ahead.
You're forgetting the one critical ingredient. If they use gold and silver, that would mean the politicians would all of a sudden have to become honest. It's like military intelligence in jumbo shrimp. Those words do not coincide and go together.
Yes, they are oxymoronical, are they not?
Yeah, an honest politician? That's like a 7-foot-tall midget.
Yeah. Well, and the only way that would be true is if you were in a room of people 10 feet tall. Then someone 7 foot tall would be a midget. But only in that case, and since that case doesn't exist.
Right.
Yeah. That's the key point here. That's the key flavor, is finding people that are honest. And we have one hell of a time doing that, because every time we turn around, the next guy they trot out, oh, he's a real guy. He's the real deal. He's changed. We can believe it. And, of course, it ends up, hey, how do you know he's lying? His freaking mouth is moving.
He's chump change. They're all chump change. They're all bought off. They find out which ones like the hookers, which one are the pedophiles, you know, which ones go for transvestites, and they find out what their weak link is, and they give them, and they feed their weak link and their Achilles heel, and then they offer them $2 million to vote this way and $1 million. And if they don't, they expose them, just like Elliot Spitzer for the $5,000 prostitutes, because he was really going after Bush and what they were doing with the banks. Had nothing to do with the prostitute. They find out what the weak chink in the armor is, they exploit it, and then they have something to hold over their heads. And the Republicans that these people, these morons, are going to vote in 2010 are going to betray them worse than the Democrats ever did. And that's what you have to give up. If for no other reason, I would join the Jehovah's religion, because they don't vote. They know it's futile. An opportunity only knocks once unless it's the Jehovah's Witness.
My problem with that is that, you know, they believe in the 144,000 going to heaven. What if you're 144,001? You're SOL, to quote my grandmama.
No, there's probably at least two or three liars that believe they're part of the 144,000. So you'll sneak in right under the wire.
He's sneaking under the wire. One more than the revelation before. Here we go.
Hey, just like the Mormon religion, they changed the rules to let in black people and drink Pepsi, you know, once the Civil Rights Act get passed, so they can keep their 501c3. All these people change the rules as they go along, just like Barack Hussein Obama, the illegal alien. They're all in the same pot. In the end times, wrong will be right, and right will be wrong, and that's exactly where we are right now.
Yeah, indeed, you are correct. Most definitely, it's you know, what's up is down, what's black is white, what's left is right, and I mean, when you sit and try to figure this out using common sense, you get a headache because there is no common sense to any of this that's going on.
There isn't enough Anacin to take to cure the headache from all this.
No, I mean, the only way to relieve it is to hit yourself in the head with a tack hammer. You know, you have to divert the pain.
That's it.
Yeah, that's the only way to do it. Brian, thanks. Go ahead.
You're welcome. Well, and it's like the real estate debacle. The minute you think it can't get any lower, it does. It's like your head's in a vice and they keep squeezing it. I mean, a 2,200-foot house in Scottsdale appraises at $320. A short sale down the road gets an offer at $290, and then some guy up the street's got 8 offers on his for $350. I said, good luck closing it. With what I know about what's going on, you'll never appraise over $320. And
right,
every million-dollar house will be worth $550, and I'll tell you why. If you buy a $600,000 house, put 20% down, that's $120,000. You're financing $480 at 6.5% on a jumbo loan. Your payments are over $3,000. You can rent that house all day long for $2,500 to $2,700. Why would anybody in their right mind put $120,000 down to have a payment that's higher than their rent? They need their head examined. Every million-dollar house in the next year be $450,000 or less, because FHA only loans up to $417,000, and at that rate, you got a little over a $2,000 payment. So it makes sense to put $20,000 or $30,000 down and have a payment that's $500 lower than your rent, but you're still fixing $5,000 AC units when they break. You're still, none of this stuff makes any sense. I hear $1 million house is selling, and I think, why would these people do it when I know that this market will go down another 30% in the next 18 months? You will see a second wave of the Alt-A loans that'll be twice as bad as the first wave, and before it's over, people will be living in cardboard boxes in parks.
Oh, I don't doubt it at all, and that's the thing. I mean, here we've got these housing prices that are so, the houses are so overvalued. I mean, we talked about this what, 2 or 3 weeks ago, when in 1960 you could buy a house for roughly three times the annual income, and now what are they looking at? Like it's one to eight, you know, eight times now, nine times, 15 times your income per year. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. And all these people sitting in these huge houses making $20,000 a year. There's no way they can pay it off. Everything's overvalued, and so everybody will end up out in the streets. It's
our
absolutely
first house was our first house was $10,000. Our second house is $30,000, and the people behind us paid $70,000, and we thought, oh my God, how can they ever afford a $500 a month payment? Our second house on a third of an acre was $27,000, 2,400 square foot, four bedroom, $30,000 with upgrades on a third of an acre in 1976.
Amazing. All right, Brian, thanks for the call. Quick break. We'll talk with Mark of Wisconsin on the other side. Stay with us. Back in the Mike Chambers radio program. Glad you're with us for the broadcast today. To the phones we go, right away to Wisconsin, to the land of the cheese. Ladies and gentlemen, let's talk to Mark. Mark, thanks for waiting. You're on the Mike Chambers radio program.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. Hey, I've been thinking about Eustace Mullins for about the last 3 days. I should have known something was going on. His name just kept popping in my head. It's sad to hear that he's passed. I don't think we could ever do justice to what this man has accomplished in his lifetime. I mean, the guy is just incredible. And his protege was actually locked up in a mental hospital for talking about the Federal Reserve.
Yep.
The man's just that, he's had an incredible life. He wrote Murder by Injection. He was talking about how they were killing us with vaccines probably 50 years ago. I mean, the people that think they're on the cutting edge of information right now, Eustace Mullins was talking about this stuff 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about this that a lot of people don't realize about this guy, is that he was really on the cutting edge of this information. I mean, he was the first guy to break ground into so many different areas that we're literally talking about every day. We're still talking and railing about the Federal Reserve. Who talked about it first? He did. We talked and rail about vaccines. Who talked about it first? He did. And you can just go on and on and on about, you know, different subjects. And a number of those subjects, it was Eustace Mullins that plowed the initial ground on it.
Right, right. He told us how the Rockefeller Trust owned the medical industry and how they were trying to kill us. He even had a book burned in Germany. I forget which one it was. But, yeah, that cracks me up. This guy actually shacked up in the Library of Congress. I mean, he's had an incredible life. We could never do him justice. He's been harangued at airports. He's been called a terrorist by the ADL. They didn't want to let him into Canada. I remember one story, Mike. He said the FBI came to his house and they knocked on his door and they said, "Can we come in, Eustace?" And he says, "No." And they says, "Well, why not, Eustace?" And he says, "Because you guys always steal something every time you come in my house." So the gentleman has just had an incredible life, and he is a credit to humanity. I mean, I just love the guy, and I hate to see him go.
Yeah, I do too. And I mean, I've had a number of conversations with others about getting these people on the record at least one more time, to talk about the things that they've experienced. And one of the things I had been doing was tracking him down. And I was close to pretty much being able to find a way to get in touch with him, and it just didn't happen. And I will forever regret that. I had just Michael Vail and I had talked about this a month and a half ago about getting him on the record one more time. And it's something that unfortunately we won't be able to do, and we'll just have to go back and listen to other things that he's done. There's a number of videos out that people have made of him, entire lectures and things that he's given. Plus, many of his books are online. You can read them for free, which is one of the great things. And that here's one of these guys that really has never protested to his information being put out there or to be given away or anything. This is certainly a guy who was not in it for the money, never got rich doing this. Matter of fact, most of the time spent his life pretty close to poverty.
Right, right. He wasn't in it for the money. He actually cared about what happened to this country. And if all of us just followed in his footsteps as best we could, we could actually create a great country again. I mean, the man is just incredible. We could sit here and talk about him for 12 hours, Mike, and it wouldn't do any justice.
Well, you know, here's this guy who was so humble, affable, good-humored, good-natured, as I said earlier, pretty much the quintessential Southern gentleman, the stereotypical Southern gentleman that you've seen, you know, in movies and read about in books. And here he is labeled by J. Edgar Hoover as the most dangerous man in the world.
That says volumes, doesn't it?
But, yeah, it certainly does. And, he was there at a time where here he is writing about these people, exposing them for who and what they are, but yet he had almost really unfettered access to the government itself. I mean, he could walk into a congressman's office and just sit down and have a conversation. He was that feared and that respected in Washington D.C. that he could go in and do things that absolutely you cannot do in this day and age.
Right, right. And I got a kick. He kind of wore it as a badge of honor that he's the only person who ever got fired from the Library of Congress for writing a book, too.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's okay that, you know, I think he ended up with the better end of the deal because he was staying there for free. I mean, and while they were paying him. I mean, that's a hell of a deal.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I heard that story. I was just wrong. He finds a dressing room in the Library of Congress and just moves in.
Well, it took me 10 minutes to get it out of him that he had appropriated the room.
Right.
He made it sound like he had rented the room, and no, he appropriated the room.
Yeah. Well, he probably thought maybe they were going to try and get back rent on him or something.
I don't know, but it was the funniest story in the world. And then, you know, then of course, you know, things that people had done to this. Here was this 85-year-old man who was perfectly capable of driving the state of Virginia because some fool decided to give him, you know, a hard time, had him listed as mentally incompetent. He was far from it. Here was a guy that was having to walk at his age to the store because he lived alone and you know, most of his life. And so here he is having to walk to the store at 85. Was the books that he had left over, he was actually walking to the post office and mailing them. I mean, that's, and so, I mean, there were so many things done to him by people that were just mean and nasty. And for him to still have the good humor about it and to be able to laugh at those stories and things, it's absolutely incredible and a credit to him as a person.
I know. Never better either. He would tell about all these tribulations in his life, and he would just laugh when he would tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Because he knew that he was having an impact on him, and what they did to him was just, you know, didn't matter. And he would just kind of giggle about it.
Yeah, it didn't matter at all. Mark, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Great memories about the Eustace Mullins. That's good stuff. I will have to post that interview I did with him, and you can listen to him. We go on and on for 10 minutes, literally, about him and his room at the Library of Congress. And finally, we get it out of him that he appropriated the room. Back in a second.